this week's programme, a journalist's view of the correct use of English. In his book Strictly English, Simon Heffer, associate editor of the Daily Telegraph, argues that there is such a thing as standard English. Its rules are set by an educated class, and those who wish to be included in that class are expected to obey the rules. There is an alternative view, more likely to be found among experts in linguistics, and that is that there are no clear objective standards in these matters, and so no group has a right to set itself up as judge and jury. Simon Heffer is insistent that his prescriptive approach to the use of English is guided not by class considerations, but by logic. With me, Jerry O'Regan, editor of the Irish Independent, Justine McCarthy, a columnist with the Sunday Times and biographer of President Mary McAleese, and Liam Fay, journalist and broadcaster. Jerry, what did you think of the book?
Well, I found it a book that it was very difficult to warm to. And in a peculiar sort of way, while it's essentially about the English language and English grammar, I think the subtext of it is a sort of political tome whereby Mr. Heffer finds an outlet for his fairly ultra-right-wing views of the world. And it's intolerant and it's very narrow, I think. And there are some peculiar old fuddy-duddy asides in it. Say, for example, he suggests that we read the Times of India, which I haven't got round to as yet, to find out how newspaper English should be. I presume the Times of India caters for some constituency out there which is a long way from the peculiarities of the market in either Britain or Ireland. And I think in a sort of a way it's summed up. He's a very harsh view of the world. I mean, he was interviewed some time back on BBC Radio, and I think that some listeners phoned in and, again, were critical of him. And his colleague in the Daily Telegraph, Charles Moore, both of them, I think, would be to the ultra-right of the British journalistic establishment, wrote a defence of him subsequently about the way he had been treated. But anyway, Simon Heffer tells us that if people are living together in this day and age and, shall we say, are partners, and one of them is unfaithful, of course, strictly speaking, which we would all agree with, the playing away partner is not guilty of adultery. But Mr. Heffer insists that they are guilty of fornication. So standards must be prevailed and the English language must be used to maintain those standards.
By and large, it's a prescriptive tone, isn't it, Justine? You know, he's laying down the law. He's very much strong. Yet there are some useful things in it.
Oh, I learned a huge amount from the book. Yes, he is a pedant and he does have a massive superiority complex. But I think every newspaper needs a Simon Heffer. You need somebody who is absolutely sure that he is correct in his use of language. Somebody who lays down the law, who is dogmatic about it, because standards have gone through the floor in newspaper writing. I think he does come across as quite fascist in his views. He's also very posh, very Daily Telegraph. You'd know that he didn't work for one of the red tops. He has a very funny chapter or passage on you versus non-you English, and it just shows how the different social classes in Britain, and it's reflected in Ireland as well, how they live their lives so completely differently to the rest of us that they actually have a whole lexicon of their own. They don't, for instance, eat sweet at the end of dinner. They eat pudding.
Yes.
And dessert, which I never knew, came after pudding and cheese.
Yes, mind you, he protests that he's not driven by class considerations, but clearly he is. Liam Fay, were you turned off by it and or did you find it useful?
It's just, I mean, he goes on a lot about how writers should avoid verbosity, but he doesn't avoid verbosity himself. I mean, it's a very tedious book to read. I don't even know that it's possible to learn the rules of grammar the way, you know, from a book the way he's outlining them there, because it's very, very dull to read. I mean, a lot of the book is taken up with him showing you how a sentence that doesn't work. So you have to read over the sentence. So it's just very, very time consuming. So if you want to learn from the book, you kind of have to read it almost a page at a time, like a sort of a daily office or some sort of religious thing. You know, that's the kind of reverence he has for grammatic rules. When he moves on then to talking about style and bad writing.
There's an idea, a daily office of grammatical
of
rules.
Grammar, yeah. But when he talks about, bad English, then he just gets into the area, you know, not only of pedantry, but of personal prejudice, really. A lot of it is just down to personal prejudice. And, I mean, you know, he devotes a whole section towards the end of the book into the correct address for members of the aristocracy and how ladies and lords should be referred to and this kind of thing. So there's a kind of a deference there, and there is definitely a class.
Oh, yeah. He refers to the many manuals. I mean, Fowler, for example, you know, the five rules, prefer the familiar word to the far-fetched. Not many would disagree with that, I suppose. Yeah.
Well, I think even the analogies he makes, for example, it's onions and partridge, and even the three writers he selects, Enoch Powell, as we know, again, politically, Barbara Pym, who I have to say I haven't read any of her stuff, and George Orwell. But I think if one takes a few of the basic points, I think there are, obviously, if one wades through it, one is, it's almost a shocking reminder, as Justine says, the way standards have slipped, perhaps in this technological age, etc., in which we live. But there are a few pedantic points I think he makes in the book, and one or two basic examples would be, for example, the difference between I will do something and I shall do something. He maintains if you say I will do something, it's a specific intent. If you shall do something, it's you're actually indicating something towards the future in a very general sense. Futurity is the word he uses.
It's a way in the distance.
It's a way in the distance. So if we say, when this programme is, I shall call a taxi, in his case, is not acceptable, you should say, I will call a taxi.
He also says it's the infallible test of the speaker of true English.
Is.
Because Irish people, Scottish people and Americans have great trouble in differentiating when we should use will and shall.
Well, I'm afraid I shall have to disagree with you there, because I think
there is a very sort of colonial attitude to the book. I mean, Justine says, you know, he refers to Irish people and Scotsmen and this sort of flouting the rules, and he's very, you know, depressingly snooty about American words and American usage. That's kind of a tired old cliche, that's railing against, you know, the word use of the word movies instead of films and elevators. Actually, there's quite a lot of American terms and American usage that actually gives writing a great bit of, you know, dash and vigour, you know?
I would agree on one thing that he points out as being a pure American import is this phrase, can I get? Yeah. And for years now, I've been going into sandwich shops and cafes and hearing people saying, can I get a latte? Yeah. And you know, that's a pure Americanism that has actually no relevance in our society.
No, but one that he complains about is the American use of the phrase meet with, to say that you met with somebody, meaning that you had a meeting with them rather than you met them for the first time. And I actually think meet with is actually quite a useful phrase. It actually distinguishes from the fact that you had a meeting rather than, you know, I met such and such a person yesterday. And does that mean you met them for the first time or you had a meeting with them?
He does have some sensible things to say, though, that avoiding ambiguity is the main point of grammatical rules generally. I mean, take the comma. I don't know about you, but I often, you know, you wonder, well, will I put a comma in or not? Or you put it in if it helps clarify. What's your attitude to the comma?
Yeah, this comes back to that great book, Eat, Shoot, Sleeves, which, you know, in the area of punctuation was far better than Simon Heffer's. But I think the comma should be probably used as little as possible. But that is predicated on the idea that we should keep our sentences short.
Yeah. And if there's likely to be confusion, you put in a comma.
That's right.
If there's confusion with that.
He gives a couple of examples. One is, quote, the body of a 45-year-old darts fan was recovered from beneath ice in a frozen lake in Frimley Green, Surrey, where he had been watching the darts world championships. Now, that's a punctuation, but it's also about the ordering, the sequence of the words. And another funny one he gives is, the Queen sent a letter of condolence to a pensioner whose dog died after he wrote to Buckingham Palace about the death. And Heffer points out that we shouldn't confuse the literary powers of the reporter who wrote that with the supernatural powers of the late departed dog.
Do you have strong views, Liam, about the semicolon and the colon?
No, I don't at all. No, I mean, I think his, you know, the one thing that he does say that you'd have to agree with, and it is useful, is that, you know, the thing about logic, you know, that a lot of English should just make sense, you know. Now, it doesn't apply to always. I mean, there's all sorts of oddities in English about, like, you know, regular plurals. The plural of mouse is mice, but the plural of spouse is not spice. These kind of things. So it's not you know, it's not a perfect rule, you know, the thing about logic. But I mean, basically, the thing, you know, rule, you know, grammatic rules are like rules of the road. You should know about them, but if you keep staring at them when you're trying to drive, you'll eventually crash. You know,
the semicolon is, I suppose, a pause for breath. I mean, you can see that. The colon, someone said to me recently that the colon is giving way to the dash.
Well, I think the inevitable triumvirate of the dash, in perhaps, or the dash, the colon, the semicolon, or even the bracket stroke parenthesis, etc. I think it's extremely difficult to be as prescriptive as Simon Heffer is in the usage of those. But I do think the ultimate, if I was to take one single thing out of it by way of learning something, and particularly from the perspective of those of us who work in newspapers, is his suggestion that one should always use the killer noun rather than resorting to adjectives with a noun to make a point. And he has one point in it whereby he makes an argument that adjectives and adverbs should be used for precision, not emphasis. And I think in newspapers, we inevitably resort a lot to adjectives, particularly in the recounting of news stories. You know, a dramatic new initiative by the government was launched last night on the economy, or a horrific crash or something like that. But his suggestion that the selection of the noun should I thought that was a very good point.
There's a wonderful quote from C.S. Lewis in 1916, the book is Studies in Words. We tend to want to express approval or disapproval of something rather than describe it. Hence the tendency of words to become more evaluative than descriptive. I find that quite interesting, that we, you know, our impulse is to say, to approve or disapprove rather than get into the hard work of describing.
He talks about that, and he talks about the onus on news reporters not to evaluate, just to report the straight facts. And I think, you know, the overall theme of the book is that he is trying to guard against the devaluing of words. Hyperbole is his great hate, really, and that's why he cautions against the overuse of adjectives, of pretentiousness.
He blames the tabloid press a lot for this. I mean, for example, you know, prices soar. Then the question, brilliant should now be used only to describe a bright light.
I mean, like, as Justine says, he goes on a lot about the, you know, over-sensitization of language and hyperbole, but he's guilty of that himself. He refers to just ordinary, everyday grammatical mistakes as barbarities or atrocities.
He's doing that
himself. And actually, the thing about tabloid language, obviously, some of it is kind of brain-dead idiocy, but there's a lot of terms that are, you know, tabloid currency, love child, Thai boy, these kind of words, you know, that are actually quite evocative and quite useful. And they say a lot in a short, punchy way, and that's what good writing should
give me another word for legendary, Jerry, which is surely an exclusive. These are words, prestigious words that are overused for an extraordinary, particularly legendary. Can you think of another word?
Well, I have to. Well, I tell you, I was going to say I'm going to try and eke out an explanation. But one of his points is you eke means to increase, to lengthen, or to add to. So if as we've often written in the newspapers, somebody was trying to eke out a living, is totally grammatically incorrect.
Tell me about your words. He talks about commonly misused words. You must have your own. Decimate means 1 in 10. It's usually used colloquially to mean to wipe out effectively. Do you have favourite words that are misused? But he gives fulsome apology.
I was surprised he didn't deal with the confusion about the verbs to steal and to rob, which is a major problem in Ireland. It mustn't be in Britain. Another one I hoped he would deal with was this common usage now of to report into something, you know, the Savile Report instead of the Savile Report on. And this has become absolutely what the BBC
is using.
And we
say, I have an inquiry, when you should say, I have a query, which is...
But he gives a very useful sort of rundown of, or run-through of words that are commonly confused with each other, like flaunt and flout, ferment and foment, formerly and formally, infer and imply, luxuriant and luxurious. And some of these, when you think about them, you're actually hard put to remember what actually is the difference. Prescription.
Yeah. Assume and presume.
Exactly.
Liam, that's often a tricky one.
Illusion and delusion is another
illusion,
one.
One of my favourites in this use word is quantum. It's in fact... in terms of its scientific origins, clearly it means something small or tiny. And it's used colloquially to mean a quantum leap, meaning a large leap.
Fraction is another one he refers to. That we always say fraction as if it is a tiny amount, but it can actually be 9/10 or 1/10.
And just by the way,
does not the whole book hinge, though, on the P word and our misuse of that? And who amongst us, in our quieter moments, would not confess that we've misused it?
Go ahead, Jerry.
Panini. Panini. Panini is the plural of panino. And is there anybody here who can, as I said, or can we collectively out ourselves by saying that there have been occasions we've gone in and asked for a panini when we only wanted one of the species?
Because it's about clarity, and if you go into insomnia and ask for a panino, they will look at you as if, what are you talking about?
By the way, he does the assume-presume distinction. He says, presume is to take it on oneself to act in a way one hasn't the authority to. Now, the euphemisms, this is, you were talking about Nancy Mitford earlier, and this is a fun part of the book, that when people say somebody passed away or passed over to the other side, this is a class thing. This is the less well-off use expression, my favourite one, which he describes in pure Monty Python as somebody has joined the heavenly choir, which is really...
Well, isn't there an undertone, though, of, I mean, poor-faced joylessness in some of this?
Yes.
I mean, the fact of the matter is people live in the real world, and there is another reality out there which is called, for good or ill, perhaps not the most august of activities, but it's called journalese.
Well, go ahead, develop that point.
But I would say is that the Daily Telegraph has a particular constituency to serve. And, I mean, all this tortuous fixation, dancing on a pinhead to try and preserve one's position in the social hierarchy. Like, say, for example, writing paper is not notepaper. Christmas lunch always, never Christmas dinner. It's always napkins, it's never serviettes. And, of course, as the recently arrived nouveau riche in Ireland should accept, it's always the lavatory and never the toilet.
Yes.
Well, it's a sofa and not a settee. And he repeats twice in the book that Britain is an old country with a class system. But, like, he should ease up a little bit about it.
Well, I think, to be fair to him, he makes it very clear that this is the lexicon that the Telegraph uses specifically for its readership.
Yeah.
And I think there is a great sense of humour in the book.
Yeah, there are some hilarious lines, like, for example, when he says, people feel if they say masticate instead of chew, they're showing a superior intellect.
I think some of the humour...
He's got to be kidding him.
Some of the funny aspects of the book are almost accidental.
Unintentional.
Yes. Yeah, unintentional, because, he takes issue with Kiss Me Quick hats on the grounds that they should say Kiss Me Quickly. You know, that's one of his, his bugbears. But I think, actually, he misses a trick. I mean, the real threat to the language is not really grammatical mistakes. I mean, that's a problem, all right. But, I mean, there's a bigger problem. Like, if you read sort of Michael Lewis's book, The Big Short, about the Wall Street meltdown, he makes it very clear that the manipulation of language was the first step there in the descent into madness. That Wall Street brokers set out to make up a language that actually disguised what they were doing, and that it was used to bewilder outsiders and to create the impression that what they were doing could not actually be translated into English. And there's a lot of this that goes on, and this happens in all sorts of areas of academia, in the law, in science, in theology. The people use language to keep outsiders out and to create an aura of sort of great importance.
It's funny you should say that, because I think it's fair to say that on the whole, brevity is more his mantra than clarity.
In those areas, that's not done out of ignorance. It's the people who are doing that are often very, very educated, classical educations of the type that Heffer would approve of, know all about their Latin and know all about grammar.
Absolutely.
But they're doing this very, very consciously. Yeah. Well, and it's the valuing of a language on that level, I think, that's more of a threat.
On the question of clarity, that I'm a great fan of Paul Krugman's, as I'm sure many of us are, in terms of the clarity of his economic writing. And I discovered that there was a profile of him done in The New Yorker which showed that I read his writing and I said, this is astonishingly clear. You know, he's a specialist. And I discovered it was his wife, who is also an economist, who does the writing. When I say she writes his pieces, I mean she edits them heavily. giving his work a remarkable clarity.
I suppose the other thing as well is, it's an awful word to mention, but the market determines.
Yeah.
And the market for particular newspapers or particular media outlets, the language is absolutely, obviously essential to the method of communication.
There's no excuse, is there, Jerry, for obscure writing?
Well, no, there isn't. And as you say, people who have specialist knowledge say, I mean, the great dream is people who will say who are top-class economists and who can write with absolute clarity. And as I said, it's a timely reminder to us all in the age we live in about rigour and objectivity and all the rest of it. But I just feel that he is just too austere and too rigid. And for example, he bemoans, I think, what newspaper recently had the shocking indictment that a car had collided with a tree. And he nearly got an angina attack because the tree, in actual fact, is not an object that moves. Now, strictly speaking, he's correct. But I just feel that he's hankering towards the leader page columns in the Times of India and Partridge Onions and Enoch Powell and all the rest of it is a misty-eyed nostalgia for an England that probably never was.
The writers he mentions, approves of Orwell, Aldous Huxley, Graham Greene, Dickens, Barbara Pym, you all may mentioned, and Enoch Powell. I mean, Powell did write with that incredible clarity. But on the question of obscure writing, there's something very aggressive, isn't there, Justine, about obscure convoluted writing. You feel it as an onslaught, an attack on you.
Yes, and as Liam was saying, you know, it very often is deliberately done by...
And it's exclusionary as well, keeping people
out. It's impenetrable. Mm. And very often you will give up halfway through a sentence rather than labour over it. But I think that the world of business, so we've seen now in the last couple of years in Ireland how our national conversation has become littered with jargon from the science of economics.
That's why, forgive me, Krugman is such a brilliant exception.
Exactly, and why somebody like Brendan Keenan in The Irish Independent is such a very good business and economics writer, because he writes for ordinary people. But Simon Heffer gives some examples of the really unappetizing jargon that has crept into our normal language as a result of sort of boardroom and corporate how-to-do manuals. And you now have clichés like programs are being rolled out for the benefit of stakeholders. Is something fit for purpose? You know, these are all things that might have been a very good idea once upon a time, but they don't mean anything at this stage. He also talks about, you know, variations of Watergate, the great 1970s journalistic scoop at the Washington Post. Now, any event, journalistic event that happens has to have gate attached.
Yes.
We had Cowan Gate last year, for instance. And I think he sets down a really good rule for this. He says, if you spot a new coinage, regard the joke as already over and move on. I think we should bear that one in mind.
I'd like him, though, to be faced with the task some nights, say, in a tabloid newspaper where he had to write a headline and he had a limited number of letters. And his primary objective was to get the maximum number of readers to read the story. And I think he might use Cowan Gate Shocks Nation or something awful, unbelievable like that, rather than underlying economic trends cause for concern.
But there's a lot of sense, though, isn't there, on the other hand, in his emphasis on brevity? I mean, you would go along with that.
Yeah, absolutely, I mean, and you know, clarity. What you're saying and all that. But, I mean, he takes another step and then he said he's very much against slang of any kind, you know, or any kind of idiomatic usage like that. And I think that's just foolish, you know. I mean,
there is an quiet anti-Americanism in his work, isn't there, in the book?
Well, old England, I mean, when they had the empire and America was in its rightful place in a secondary position. I mean, there is this endless hankering for. And I think a terrible...
What you're really saying, Jerry, in a nice way, is that the context here is the loss of empire since the end of the
19th
century.
It's the loss of empire. Yeah. There is a strain in the cultural comeback,
yes.
There's a strain in the Telegraph newspapers which at times becomes increasingly pathetic. I go back to my original point in a sort of a way. His politics, his philosophy and his sociological outlook underpins much of his views of the English language.
He applies
a certain amount of rigour which all of us need to be reminded of every now and again. Yeah. But in that sense, that's the undertone
to
the book.
I think we might bemoan his prescriptive attitude. Not that I think we all have an element of that in us. In other words, there are certain words that are no-go areas for us, Justine.
Absolutely. We all have our...
Certain usages, yeah.
Yeah, we all have our bugbears.
Yeah.
I think I mentioned a couple of mine a while ago.
Yes.
And I think we're all entitled to them. But what I found extraordinary about the book is really how little I knew. They say in order to be a good writer, you have to know all the rules and then break them. And James Joyce, I suppose, was the ultimate example of that. He's mentioned once in this entire book. Heffer goes on at great length about overwriting sentences, and he gives a couple of examples of sentences that run to well over 100 words. Well, if he wanted to give the prime example, you know, Ulysses would have been that. And he doesn't mention Irish writers other than that one allusion to Joyce. But I think his choice of his own, as he calls them, three saints, is interesting because he favours journalists. I suspect he has a high regard for well-written journalism, and he makes the point...
I think you're absolutely
right.
That
journalism is the main diet for most people.
Absolutely right, because I think that if he puts that emphasis on the avoidance of ambiguity, clearly he's ruling out literature tout court in the sense that what defines a lot of good literature is the fact that it is ambiguous.
Yeah. And there's an implied admiration for tabloid journalism or tabloid journalese when it's done well, because it is the ultimate in precision and concision.
Yeah, but I think you know he is good on the importance of brevity and the importance of clarity and things like that. But his own frame of reference is just so narrow. A lot of the analogies he uses, you know, give away his sort of colonial class attitude. He uses a lot of analogies about the royal family, the English military, and cricket. He returns again and again to cricket. He agonises over whether you should say England are bowling or England is bowling.
Of course, and you do know that a ship of the Royal Navy is never a boat,
not,
Liam.
Yeah,
you do know that.
Of course, when they're playing Ireland, the important usage is England are losing. That, you know, he doesn't seem to make that point. But the, I think his frame of reference is so narrow that that's the rock that he perishes on, if that's a cliche he wouldn't approve of. But that, again and again and again, you know, the impulses are fine. His own frame of reference is just too narrow.
We've been discussing Strictly English by Simon Heffer, published by RH Books. My thanks to Justine McCarthy, Liam Fay and Jerry O'Regan. You can listen to the programme again on our off-the-shelf website at rte.ie. Till next week, bye-bye.